I think that he was truthful to whatever he believed, and that he gave up his architectural talent for his ideology. At the very end, what he wanted was to build a new world. That was his aim. My name is Raquel Franklin. I came in contact with Hannes Maya many, many years ago when I wrote my dissertation. So I see Hannes Maya as someone really close to me. He has been with me for the last 25 years at least.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to the last part of my episode about the second Bauhaus director, Hannes Maya. If you haven't listened to part one with Derek Kiese and Thomas Flehl and part two with Tatjana Ifusi yet, please go back and listen to those parts first to fully understand what we are actually talking about today. We have ended part two with Hannes Maya leaving the Soviet Union to go and help build a socialist republic in Spain, which was interrupted by the Franco coup and left Maya in limbo in his home country, Switzerland. Here, he married Lena Bergner in 1937. They already had a daughter, Lilo, back then. In 1938-39, Hannes Maya built the orphanage Mimliswil, which I have discussed more extensively at the end of part two. In this new episode, I have invited the Mexican art historian Raquel Franklin to talk about Maya's next and last immigration to Mexico between 1938 and 1949, about which she wrote her PhD thesis. What were his goals and opportunities in Mexico? Was Maya really a spy for the Soviets? What was the Black Book of Nazi Terror and Maya's role in it? And why did he leave Mexico too, ending up again in Switzerland and not in another socialist country like the GDR? As in parts 1 and 2, I will bring in former Berlin Senator for Culture Thomas Flehl to share his research results and expertise too. Without any further ado, let's dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Hannes Maya's life and work in Mexico.
Maya came to Mexico for the first time in 1938. So there was a conference on urban planning. It was truly his chance to get to know the Mexican environment, to see if he was able to get some appointment at a university or whatever job he could get. And in fact, it wasn't his first option. So he wanted to travel to the U.S., thinking that people like Gropius or Miss Van der Rohe were able to get a position in a university there. Why not try that way? So he contacted his friend Simon Brynes, that I believe he met him at some point in the Soviet Union. So Brynes was working in Boris Yofan's team for the Palace of Soviets, and I believe they met there. Then Brynes became his contact in the U.S., and he recommended to look for Alfons Goldschmidt. So Goldschmidt met Maya around 1930, I believe, in a lecture in Berlin. They weren't so much in contact at the time, but Brynes suggested that Goldschmidt was the right guy to ask for some recommendations in the U.S. Goldschmidt was suggesting some kind of position at the University of Exile, probably.
I would just like to very shortly explain what the University in Exile was. The university was established in 1933 at the New School for Social Research in New York by Alvin Johnson. Johnson was then the president of the New York New School for Social Research. A year prior to the founding of the University in Exile, he had traveled to Europe. Through this journey and through his frequent correspondence with German Jewish scholars who contributed entries for the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences that Alvin Johnson co-edited, he understood the necessity for an intellectual haven for European academics and scholars, primarily Jewish and politically dissident scholars who were being expelled from their positions by the Nazi regime. Of course, Hannes Maya would have been a perfect fit for that university, as he was being dismissed from the Bauhaus in 1930 due to his leftist political views. But obviously, at this point here, we're now in 1936, he did not have the right connections to make it happen. I wonder if Hannes Meyer would have become as popular an architect as Walter Gropius and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, first and third directors of the Bauhaus, if he had had the opportunity to teach at the university in exile. But as this didn't happen, how did he get to Mexico then?
Goldschmidt, it took some time for him to answer, so he suggested some options. But one of the options was, why not Mexico? So he said, here it's not so clear. He actually was having so many troubles himself in the U.S. And he said, maybe it's not the right place for you to come. So Hannes even asked, what are the chances to get a job at the University of Exile? I'm going to be free to speak about any kind of topic. What if I'm speaking about Marxism? Will be any kind of censorship, or I will be free to speak whatever I want? If he would be able to bring his communist library with him. So he was really worried about censorship. And I believe somehow Goldschmidt sensed that fear, and he said maybe Mexico would be a much better option. So apparently Goldschmidt was in contact with Vicente Lombardo Toledano, and he actually was a very close friend of Jesús Silva Herzog. So apparently it was Vicente Lombardo Toledano, the head of the Mexican Trade Union Confederation, and it was him who suggested that he should come to that conference on planning and urbanism and get to know the intellectual environment, the architectural environment, and see if there was some kind of chance for him to come. So he arrived in Mexico in August of 1938. He attended the conference. And during the conference, he met some of the artists of the Taller de Gráfica Popular, the workshop of popular graphics. And he met as well people really involved in architectural training in Mexico, especially Enrique Yáñez and José Luis Cuevas. So José Luis Cuevas was the one who suggested for him to have a couple of talks at the San Carlos Academy. It was the only school of architecture at the time. And it was recently opened, ESIA, the School of Architecture and Engineering in the Politecnico. So there were the only two schools training architects at the time in Mexico. And he gave two talks that they were very much aligned with the idea of getting the job. So he gave the first one, Training of an Architect, and he spoke of all of his experiences, the Bauhaus and in the Soviet Union, teaching architecture, and how he saw the possibility to translate somehow the ideas from the Bauhaus to Mexico. So he spoke about that difference between Mexico and Germany. So he said there's no possibility to just bring the ideas from the Bauhaus to a completely different context. So that was the first one. The second one was on urban planning. And he spoke basically on his experiences in planning in the Soviet Union. So having that in mind, then at that conference in planning, there was one of the lectures that had a very important impact on his possibilities to get the job, that was one on the lack of proper training in urban planning in Mexico. Said we haven't a school that is working specifically on planning, and we should have one. So that opened the way for him to get an invitation to lead a seminar on urban planning at the Polytechnic Institute. So that was the very early stage. They planned together with José Luis Cuevas and Enrique Yáñez the curriculum for some kind of seminar. Eventually, it grew into a postgraduate program that it was supposed to be a two-year program for engineers, architects, and sociologists, and so everyone that was related to the discipline. But he met some troubles in the way. So first of all, his political position. As a Stalinist, he was confronted with Juan O'Gorman, that was a Trotskyite. So that was the very first political encounter that somehow hindered his possibilities of getting ahead at the Polytechnic. So O'Gorman was the founder of the ESIA, and as such, he had a very strong influence on people making the decisions there. And the second one, it had to do with the head of the School of Architecture and Engineering, the ESIA, that was Guillermo Terrés. So Terrés had some valid arguments. He said, okay, how come that a foreigner who doesn't speak the language will be teaching, planning to our students that they do not speak any other language but Spanish? That's going to be really difficult. And he presented a budget. Terrés said, what we're going to pay for this foreigner is 3 times higher than what we can pay for 3 Mexican professionals. So why shouldn't we bring Mexicans instead? It makes more sense. So that was not Meyer's reading. So his reading of the entire argument was, this is xenophobia, and they are envious about my position and my salary, and it's all about the intrigues that they are doing against me. But, you know, if you read both arguments, then, okay, there's some reason behind all of that beyond the political orientation. Between 1938, that he came for the first time and he brought the proposal to establish the institute. Then he came back in 1939, already with the visa and with the contract. And he even got the promise that his wife, Lena, was going to get a teaching position as well. So that was, I would say, very kind of him to think of her not being just a wife, but being a professional. More than the passionate love, as you can read from the letters to Lotte Beze, for example, you do not see that kind of love with Lena. It's more that sense of comradeship, of trust, of mature love. They shared a common vision. 1939, he came permanently, so to speak, and they opened the institute until 1941. So it took more than a year in planning and trying to implement it. So it was really hard for him to make it work. So they started working, and he complained about the level of instruction, the facilities. So he said, now I have a so-called Institute of Planning with 5 desks and 7 hungry students. There's no way I can work with that. And they are very well trained in mathematics, in engineering, but they have no clue about planning or architecture. So there's nothing I can work with. After 1 year of working with them, he was requested to design an expansion for the Polytechnic Institute. So together with his students, he was designing the new campus, I believe, because there's no evidence of that. He said that it was going to be a very large campus with a swimming pool, with plenty of workshops and sporting facilities, but there's absolutely no evidence of that. You know, for someone like Meyer, who kept absolutely everything, it is kind of weird that there's no single evidence, not a sketch, nothing but what he said, that he spent most of the time with his students working on that, but not a single evidence of that, not in the Polytechnic archives, not in the National Archives, not in Meyer's archives. So I believe it never happened, or if it happened, it was of such a bad quality that he didn't want to keep it because he complained all the time about the quality of the students. So I think that they never got anything of value that he could rescue from there. Designing the new campus took most of the time they needed for the proper assignments in urban planning. When the first year ended, there were no proper results. So he said, okay, this is the first year. I always planned it as a 2-year program. So you cannot stop it because the first year would be about analysis and the second one will be about the synthesis. So if you cut it at the middle, then all of our job will be missed because we are never going to get the final result out of that. So they said, okay, let's try some other alternatives and you should bring a new proposal. So there was some kind of confusion. So he didn't bring the proposal on time. And then when he brought the new proposal, they didn't agree with that proposal either. There were really a lot of misunderstandings and troubles inside the Polytechnic. Eventually, they got into the political scene because someone forgot, so to speak, maybe it was intended just to forget, to bring the documents to the Foreign Affairs Ministry and renew his visa. So they didn't renew the visa on time. Then he was accused of extending his stay in Mexico illegally. And that was the beginning of the entire political process against his staying in the Polytechnic. So being accused of exceeding his time in Mexico illegally, he had to, of course, complain and bring the Swiss embassy to speak on his behalf. And the contact he had, Batis, in the Secretariat of Education, he somehow intervened and eventually his visa was renewed, but it was reason enough to cancel the program at the Polytechnic. So, because he was hired during Lázaro Cárdenas' government that was on the left. And then 1940, we had elections here and then there was a presidential change to Manuel Ávila Camacho, and things were not as smooth as they were with Cárdenas for him, because, as they say, the scope moved, they say, to the right. It was basically to the center, but he didn't find all of the confidence he had before with Cárdenas. And Ávila Camacho said, okay, this is not what I want. I don't want to get troubles everywhere. We have enough troubles just to get into that. So apparently it was direct order from the president to close the institute, according to that, because of budgetary issues. So between 1940-41, the institute was open. 41, they finally closed it. He was in very good terms with Juan de Dios Batis, that was working at the time at the Secretariat of Education, and he was the one who solved the problem with the visa and all of that. And eventually, Batis was relocated to another secretariat, so it was the beginning of the Secretariat of Labor. And he was not the secretary, but he got some kind of department in planning and building as part of the Secretariat of Labor. So there was a change in Mexican law that every single industry having more than 150 employees was compelled to give them some kind of housing. So that was the chance to open a new department in housing as part of the Secretariat of Labor. So he was recommended to take that position, and he started working for the Secretariat of Labor as the head of the housing and planning department. He developed a very interesting urban plan for a housing estate called Lomas de Becerra. So Lomas de Becerra was in a suburb of Mexico City at the time. Today is very central in Mexico City. And it was planned just to give housing to the workers of the paper industry that was nearby. So he developed what he called this flexible scheme that had, let's say, a central corridor with all of the main facilities, the market, the school. All of those facilities were exactly at the center of the line and housing on both sides. surrounded by all of this infrastructure, with the power station, with the sewage system, so everything that ran around the entire neighborhood. So there were 6 mega blocks. Each one had a different density, and they were somehow linked by this central block of institutions that went together. So he was planning to have some mid-rise buildings, 4 or 5 levels in each one. And that was absolutely innovative in Mexico. So the first time that something like that was built was in 1947, the Miguel Alemán Urban Center by Mario Pani. But he was the first to suggest something like that. It was never built. But in any case, it was an interesting project that was meant to solve a real issue with the housing in Mexico. So that came together with a study he did and published in the magazine Arquitectura México on urban planning and housing development in Mexico City. And he studied the way of life of the Mexican people. So his project was supposed to be based on, let's say, the traditional way of life in the vecindad, that people came together in the courtyard. So he tried to understand that aspect of the Mexican way of life and how to translate it into modern buildings. So it was a nice exercise to understand his text in Arquitectura and how it was translated into a real project in Lomas de Becerra. The buildings were very similar to those of Torten. As building itself, the idea of having the corridor in the outside and then a line of apartments with the installations in front, that was basically modeled after Torten. And the scheme he developed as planning, it was, according to him, modeled on the elastic scheme he developed in the Soviet Union. I do not see many similarities, for example, with Birobidzhan. That is something radically different from what he did in Mexico. But in any case, the idea of the mega block and the way he managed different social aspects of getting all of these facilities inside the community and this kind of flexible organization, it was derived from his experiences in the Soviet Union. But that also failed, so he never built the Lomas de Becerra, and partly because they opened the National Institute for Social Security in 1944, and Batis was sent to that institute as well. So as part of Batis's team, Meyer eventually was called to the Institute of Social Security, so he started working there instead. His salary was not what he expected, but in any case, he struggled the entire time because of budgetary issues. So it was never enough. He complained that he was getting the salary of a draftsman instead of that of an architect, and he had to survive with less of what he deserved. And at some point, he even was truly struggling because of his financial condition. That when he came to Mexico, he told Goldschmidt that he had some savings to manage some short period of time fine, that he would prefer to get to a place where he can develop his ideological and social life rather than getting to a place where it was all about getting a good salary. But in any case, that was gone as well because he struggled so hard to get his payment. And then the salary went really low. And at some point, he was jobless, waiting for something else to happen. So it wasn't easy for him to manage the budgetary issue specifically. After the Secretariat of Labor, he worked for the Social Security Institute. And he was the architect secretary in planning the entire architectural program for the first zone hospital in Mexico. So he was in charge of developing the program, the architectural program, together with the medical secretary. Then he was the one who organized the competition for that first zone hospital. Eventually, Enrique Yáñez won the first prize, and that was the hospital that was finally built. And he complained as well of some political intrigues. It was already the time under Manuel Ávila Camacho. So as I said, Manuel Ávila Camacho was more to the center. So he moved the political sphere to the right. And he didn't feel really comfortable in there. So he said, when you can feel the opposition coming, then it's time to leave. And he left the secretariat. At the same time, he was offered some job at the CAPSE. So the CAPSE was the administrative committee for the school construction program. So it was also launched in 1944. With a very interesting national program in school construction. So every single state would get a head architect and they will do some really interesting research. He was commissioned to organize that big, big exhibition on school construction. So each one of the states brought their proposal and they organized a very large exhibition in the Palace of Fine Arts. At the entrance, he designed a rural classroom and an urban classroom in a one-to-one scale. So people could immediately relate to the building itself and how does it feel to have a school in one or another site. Then you entered and the entire vestibule was full of these models of each one of the main schools, specifically those in Mexico City, with the main four architects in charge. And there was a very large map of the entire republic with the states that participated in the program. By the way, the charts were designed by the artist of the Taller de Gráfica Popular together with Lena. So Lena had an important participation as well in all of this graphic design. Basically, the charts that were fantastic and they brought so much information that reflected as well his clear and systematic methodology in analysis and how he presented things that eventually you will see that very same process in what he did for Agua de Honda, for example.
Although the Taller de Gráfica Popular, the TGP, which literally translates to Workshop for Popular Graphics, was mentioned only very shortly at this point, Raquel will get back to it in a minute and explain much more about the TGP's work and artists involved. For now, it is just important to know that Hannes Meyer founded the TGP's publishing house, La Estampa Mexicana, in 1942, and that he would become later head of the TGP, though in an honorary, unpaid position. Lena Meyer Bergner's role in the TGP and specifically her charts that she designed for the school exhibition that Raquel is talking about right now will be discussed in the next episode of Bauhaus Faces about her with Sandra Neugärtner and Viridiana Rivera Zavala in much more detail. Just to give you a little spoiler to make sure that you will return for that episode too, Lena Meyer Bergner, who had studied weaving at the Bauhaus and had become a prolific textile designer that provided for her family with her designs during this in-between time between the Soviet Union and Mexico in Switzerland. She reinvented herself in Mexico and became involved in graphic design, especially in concentrating in isotypes, a method that had been invented in the 1920s to educate with pictures. ISOTYPE is an acronym for International System of Typographic Picture Education. So stay tuned for the next episode about Hannes Meyer's wife too. If you can't wait for it though and need to read more about the isotypes in the exhibition, I will link you a wonderful article with Sandra Neugärtner in the show notes. It's in German though, so maybe you'll come back next time after all. But for now, let's get back to Raquel Franklin, who will continue to describe this big and important school exhibition. For photos of the exhibition, take a look in the show notes where I have linked an article by Raquel about the exhibition for you.
So there were plenty of models, and there were as well plans, and well, it was for the general audience. So basically they related much better to models. So that's the main product that we see in that exhibition. But there were some plans and of course the charts and the maps. So it was a very comprehensive exhibition, and all of that eventually became part of the catalog. There are many pictures of the exhibition, and there are some copies of the catalog that you can see all of that work as well. It was really successful. And he was also commissioned with the printing of the catalog for schools. So he was in charge of the archive. He worked really hard on doing that exhibition because it was in a very short period of time. And he said, all of my architect colleagues believe that I am the only one who is able to organize such a large exhibition in such a short period of time. And he actually did a great job at that. The very last epoch, he worked for the Taller de Gráfica Popular, and it was really fulfilling. And this was a community of artists, all of them to the left, of course. They started working even before 1938 as the LEAR, it was called.
So the abbreviation LEA stands for Liga de Escritores y Artistas Revolucionarios, League of Revolutionary Writers and Artists. It was established in 1933 when, after the Mexican Revolution, the country experienced an uplift of the arts, education and culture. LEA aimed to help workers by fighting for fairness against censorship and supporting global revolutions. This league slowly but surely dissolved. Some of the artists involved with LEA then founded the TGP, the Taller de Gráfica Popular, an artists' print collective, in 1937. It turned into a hub for political action and creativity, attracting many international artists to join in.
So 1938, it was properly the year they started to work hand in hand with the Spanish exile and with the German exile as well. So 1939, that most of them came, they, through Leopoldo Méndez, the head of the Taller de Gráfica Popular, started a very strong collaboration with the Heinrich Heine Club and later with Freies Deutschland. It was basically to support the Spanish Republicans that came to Mexico, the Spanish exile. So that was the first contact Meyer had with them. It was in 1938 already as he came to Mexico. So it was not only the political side of the Taller de Gráfica Popular. They were really active in graphics, and they were also painting murals around the country and trying to somehow promote muralism that in Mexico was at its peak. So people like Ángel Bracho, for example, were painting some murals. And Meyer got really close to that at the very beginning. So he was trying to understand how the frescoes were done with the Mexican dyes and if they were importing it from Belgium, all the paintings, or if they were taken from nature in Mexico. And he was actually discussing that with his European friends, with Hans Berger, for example. He wrote a lot about what these painters were doing in the sense of mural painting as well. And that established a close bond between Meyer and the artists. They were very much working in the very same sense, in the arts and in the political sense. So he found a community of Mexicans, and eventually some foreigners got into the TGP as well. But he found that community where intellectual life could flourish. That was exactly what he was looking for when he came to Mexico. And I believe that the possibility of having these young artists, eventually two of them were their neighbors in the very same building. So it was a close community of intellectuals and artists that he felt really comfortable with them. So they got into some kind of financial struggle. And Meyer came to the help with, again, his systematic methodological way of thinking. So he became at some point the administrator of the TGP. He was also managing all the contacts of the TGP to the outside. At the same time, he was working together with the exile in publishing the Black Book of Nazi Terror in Europe. So he was the editor and he was the one who selected the images. So El Libro Negro, there was a first attempt in the Soviet Union that Ilya Ehrenburg and Vasily Grossman tried to publish, and they were unable to do that, at least not at that time. But in Mexico, there was this counterpart of this black book that they were able to get all of these intellectuals participating in writing articles, in designing all of the images. They got many, many articles of very famous people like Thomas Mann, for example. He wrote an article for the book. There was Anna Zegers and this André Simonet and so many others. He really was able to get in contact the people of the Taller de Grafica with the exile. And it was a very fruitful relationship that eventually it happened in so many ways. So, for example, Meyer prepared a series of lectures for the Workers' University that was part of a larger program with the Heinrich Heine Club and supported by Vicente Lombardo Toledano. So everything was so linked together. It was impossible to take one part away because at some point Meyer became that piece that somehow linked everything together. Again, it's something that he didn't get any kind of recognition for that, but you can see it from his letters, you can see it from what he did, and always appearing just as images, photographs, Hannes Meyer. And that's it. But behind the scenes, he did all of that linking between different groups of the Mexican society with the exiles in many, many ways. He did a couple of pavilions at the book fair in 1943, one for the Red Army, the support agency for the Red Army, and the other one on the anti-fascist struggle. So he did all of these pavilions. And in 1946, he did another pavilion for the Friends of the Soviet Union. After that experience in CAPSE, designing the school exhibition, that didn't go very well either. So again, he complained of Mexicans not being strict in keeping timing. And he complained about José Luis Cuevas, that he was already senile and didn't answer to what they requested from him. And that there were four different heads in that institute. So he didn't know to whom he should pay attention. And again, it was basically that he was uncomfortable with the entire situation in there. So eventually in 1946, again, Juan de Dios Batis, his former friend from the very early stage, got an appointment as the head of an important bank in Mexico that financed some projects, including the urban planning for a spa in Cuautla. So it was called Agua de Onda. So he was in charge of the entire planning and the regional development of Agua de Onda and Cuautla. That, again, it didn't happen the way he imagined it, because 1946, we had a very heavy economic crisis. The peso devalued 3 times its value, and he lost all of his savings at the time. So he got his payment for the project, but the project never came into real life. The same happened with the Corpus Christi block. So it was supposed to be a plan for two different banks in central Mexico. So it was an interesting project that he removed one of these remaining chapels of a convent of the 16th century. He wanted to put it on wheels and remove it from the place it was, and then build some skyscrapers instead. So he did the entire project. It was basically an economic analysis of the possibilities for that specific site in central Mexico City. And he said, as you can see, communists are good planners as well, and they know of economics. So he struggled all the time. It was a bittersweet experience because he really got good jobs and very close friends. But at the same time, he struggled all the time because of budgetary issues, because I don't know if he was paranoid or not, but he felt that every time the rightists were against him, or the Trotskyists were against him, or everyone was making some kind of complot against him and boycotting him. So it was kind of that feeling that he wasn't completely comfortable here. All the time he was saying, I don't know what the destiny has for me. Probably I will end up in China. And, you know, it was all the time that feeling of not being at home, that uneasiness.
I wondered if Hannes Meyer ran into complications with the Mexican government for his strong affiliations with the Soviets. Well, he designed a number of pavilions for them and also painted a mural in the Soviet embassy in Mexico.
Well, there was no problem because actually Mexico entered the war in 1942. So now the Soviet Union were the allies as well. So there was no conflict with that. So they renewed this diplomatic relationship with the Soviet Union, and they had Umansky as an ambassador. And that was really important because Umansky was the ambassador to the U.S. before coming to Mexico. So that gave relevance to Mexico as an important participant. And since Mexico was the one that allowed the Spanish Republicans to come to the country, so they were very much aligned with the leftist position that Lázaro Cárdenas established. And of course, it changed with Ávila Camacho and later on with Miguel Alemán. But at the time, there was no conflict between that kind of participation and the Mexican position regarding the war. And actually, the president, Ávila Camacho, was one of the sponsors of the Black Book of Nazi Terror in Europe. In that sense, the Mexican government completely supported all kind of anti-fascist struggle. And in that sense, the connection to the Soviet Union was in no way something problematic for him.
Raquel had hinted at a mural that Hannes Meyer had painted at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. Of course, I wanted to know what that painting was about. What did it look like?
What he painted in the embassy, it was a mural of the 1st of May celebrations in the Red Square. It was basically socialist realism that, of course, he somehow defended it strongly, at least in ideological terms. So he said, well, probably formally he wouldn't relate so much to that, but he made some kind of discourse supporting socialist realism specifically for people that are not intellectually developed. So he said, if you want to approach the people, then you should be clear in your message. And the best way to do it is to be realistic about that. Well, what you see is the fireworks in the Red Square with San Basilius to the back. And, you know, it's what it is. So it's interesting that I actually heard the part of the podcast on Fritz Kur.
In case you're wondering which podcast Raquel is talking about, well, for those of you who are frequent listeners, you of course know that it's an episode of Bauhaus Faces with Ute van Muller about the Bauhaus student Fritz Kur. He's a very interesting person too. He used to be the student representative at the Bauhaus and was closely knit to the Bauhaus directors, first to Walter Gropius and then obviously to Hannes Meyer too. Well, if you would like to listen to this episode, just go back in the timeline and look for Fritz Kur with Ute van Muller.
He wrote a letter to Kur speaking of that idea of the socialist realism somehow. So at some point they had some kind of discussion about what is art. So Meyer said, art is order. So that was the phrase he used sometime before, probably at the Bauhaus time. And then in one of those letters in 1947, he wrote, as you can see, my friend Fritz Kur, art is order, but not only. So he completed the phrase. And that was interesting in connection to that idea of what he drew at the embassy. So he did that. And then in the pavilion, what you can see is, again, the heroes of the Soviet Revolution. And, you know, it's just these figurative expressions that Lena was mostly in charge of all of that. But he did an exhibition on the Soviet conditions during the war. You know, he wrote an article on Soviet architecture and what was the fate of the buildings he designed and, you know, what was happening in the Soviet Union. So he had that exhibition first in his own house, and then he brought it to the pavilion. He actually had many of these kind of encounters in his own apartment. So his apartment was the venue of many political events and exhibitions and meetings of all of these people from the exile, from the political scene in Mexico, specifically related to the Taller de Gráfica Popular. So it was really interesting what happened in his own apartment. So his apartment was a modern one, with very large white walls and a large living room connected to the dining room. So he had this diagonal large table where he hosted all of these reunions. So he had this welfare fest for the Contreras. Contreras was one of these very weird guys that came from Italy and he fought in the Spanish Civil War. So he was called Carlos Contreras, but he was truly Vittorio Vidali. So this spy has a very large history of political involvement and spying. So he was very close to very questionable people, and he befriended with all of them. And his place was that specific place where things were happening. And that's also very interesting. Meyer came to Mexico under the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas, who was a leftist. So Lázaro Cárdenas was the one who received the Spanish exile coming from the Spanish Civil War. So the Republicans came to Mexico as part of that exile. And together with them came the German exile, or a big part of the German exile, that there were many intellectuals that were fighting together with the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War. So as part of the international brigades, they were also welcomed to Mexico. So in Mexico, we had a very large Spanish exile and some smaller groups from Germany, from Italy, and from other countries that somehow fought together with the Republicans. There was an important representation as well of the Czechs that were expelled as well. Meyer found in Mexico that kind of very optimistic atmosphere to develop his own political views. So he immediately became in contact with all of these foreign groups, because he had very clear that as a foreigner, he was unable, or he was very much aware that he couldn't participate in Mexican politics. So they were really strict on that. And he was very much aware of the dangers of participating in Mexican politics. That didn't stop him from commenting and being, you know, behind the curtain, this very important influence, because he was truly knowledgeable about Marxism, about what Stalinism meant, and all of this leftist politics. So he was kind of a father figure for many Mexican intellectuals that wanted to get involved into the political world of communism. So somehow he did it behind the curtain. But that was completely different regarding the exiles working in Mexico. So he was very active in many organizations, first in the Heinrich Heine Club, and then in Freies Deutschland, until he got into trouble with Paul Merkel, and then he just quit the organization. But he was truly active, at least during the first years, and he wasn't truly acknowledged for all the work he did behind the scene. He was able to have some funding collects, and he was the one who got the first typewriting machine for Anna Seghers, for example, where she wrote the novel Transit. So he did all of that. And for example, he requested the Mexican government to give working permits to many of those refugees who were staying in the country as refugees but had no rights to work. And he somehow, together with Francesco Frolla, was the one who wrote to the Ministry of Interior to ask for these working permits. And he was the one who administered the fellowship. He received the money, he administered the money. So he actually did a lot of work on behalf of the refugees to get them visas, to allow them working permits, to getting jobs for them, to make collects. And he wasn't acknowledged for that because he never took first stage. And the same can be said about what he was accused of, that he was a Soviet spy. So probably it was exactly the same condition that he worked behind the scene. And as he did in the case of getting benefits for the refugees, he probably did it as well in whistleblowing some secrets. I don't know, because there's no clear evidence of that. So there were accusations. An FBI agent accused him of spying and that he was the head of the Comintern in Mexico and that he did a lot of spying. But what you can find is somehow subjective evidence. So there's this FBI report that he went to the Soviet embassy with a wooden box and then he went out and had lunch with Kepesh that was visiting in Mexico. And then he went back to the Soviet embassy with the wooden box. And he was painting a mural inside the embassy. So maybe it was just his materials. So you never know. There are accusations. I don't know if they can be truly supported.
Well, Raquel's statement really got me interested, and I wondered what Thomas Flier might say about that. So I'm bringing him back now.
Mexiko war natürlich als einer auch nach dem Erfahrung des Scheiterns der Spanischen.
Mexico was, of course, one of the most important outposts of the Communist International on the American continent. Even after the experience of the failure of the Spanish Republic and the many immigrants who came to Mexico from Spain and France. And a large part of the communication with the USA was, of course, also channeled through Mexico. That goes as far as the Soviet ambassadors switching between Washington and Mexico City, and that certain financing and informal channels naturally also ran via Mexico. So it is clear that it is also documented by Hannes Meyer's testimonies after the war that he performed an important administrative function for the Comintern in Mexico, illegally and covertly, which also affected him greatly and, incidentally, was also leaked and publicly negotiated in Swiss newspapers, so that he also lost his functions with the Mexican state for this reason, especially after the change of presidencies.
Auch deswegen seine staatlichen Funktionen, vor allem nach dem Wechsel der Präsidentschaften, auch seine Position wieder los wurde.
This whole story about Hannes Meyer's alleged spy activity for the Soviets and his position as head of the Comintern really made me curious. Why do Raquel and Thomas both understand the facts in different ways? It was enough for me to dive into some more research myself, and I found an article by Dara Kieser, whom you've already met in the first part of the Bauhaus Faces episode on Hannes Meyer. It is called Amerikanische Linke, the American Political Left, and the FBI, and was published in Hannes Meyer im Streit der Deutungen by Philip Oswald and Thomas Flehl. In her article, Dara Kieser explains that Hannes Meyer, though he was highly motivated and confident about his immigration to Mexico, but also highly aware of the fragile political situation there and afraid of losing his work at the Polytechnical Institute once the government changed, which is what actually happened afterwards. So Meyer was again looking for possibilities to work in the US during the 1940s, supported by his employee and friend Catherine K. Adams. Catherine's mother, the German painter Martha Adams, who lived in Mexico City at the time, asked her to use her personal connections to Boston to establish contact possibilities for Hannes Meyer. Kay studied at MIT in Boston at the time. Even before she worked for Meyer in the summer break of 1942, she had already managed to have Dean Walter McCormick invite Meyer for a lecture series at MIT, but Hannes Meyer didn't respond to it. On 17th of May 1940, the U.S. Immigration Services asked Hannes Meyer to provide information about his stays and work in the USA, maybe triggered by Kay's efforts. Meyer then gave specific details about his journeys to the United States and mentioned that he had first traveled through New York to attend an international congress for urban planning on 8th and 9th of August 1938 as part of the Swiss delegation, and that he stayed there on his return trip from 30th of November until 2nd of December. He came a second time to New York with his family to visit the New York's World Fair in May of 1939 for 10 days. Alongside Dara's article, you can even find two pages of the FBI file about Hannes Meyer, and you can read it yourselves if you want to. Of course, I will link the article in the show notes for you. Facts are that Hannes Meyer was monitored by US authorities between 1940 and 1946. Meyer was spied on in Mexico by five informants. One of them allegedly was the Mexican painter and Frida Kahlo's husband, Diego Rivera. And I'm now quoting excerpts from the FBI file, so there's no filter and you can then judge for yourselves. Quote, Source A, of unknown reliability, reported that Hannes Meyer has been and is the leader of the GPU in Mexico and the real, though not publicized, head of the Mexican, Spanish and German branches of the Communist Party in Mexico. This same source reported subject as a member of Alemania Libre. Source B, of unknown reliability, substantiated the above information and added that he continues to operate, though undoubtedly known to Mexican officials of the Department of Gobernación, to be acting in such a capacity. This source states further that Meyer was the engineer of the assassination of Leon Trotsky and that he formerly held a position in the Mexican Department of Education and had, at his disposal, unlimited funds from the department. End quote. A third source, this time of known reliability, then only reports on Hannes Meyer's biographical background and the circumstances of his immigration to Mexico. Then follows a listing of different activities of Hannes Meyer, mostly visits to the Russian embassy or to Imre Kepish or Lorenzo Gomez. In summer of 1945, you can find the visits that Raquel was talking about earlier. I will quote for you directly. 2nd of June 1945. Meyer went to the Russian embassy at 4:25 p.m., carrying a briefcase and two small wooden boxes. He apparently left the latter items at the embassy. 2nd of July 1945. He visited the Swiss embassy, Londres 12, for 5 minutes in the morning. In the afternoon, he picked up 3 wooden boxes at a carpenter shop located at Callejon Durango No. 6 and carried them to the Russian embassy, arriving at 1 p.m. He stayed at the embassy until 8:05 p.m. In any case, now you all know the hard facts about the story. What could seem suspicious may be innocent, as Raquel stated, or it could mean more, like Thomas said. Let's go back to Raquel now before you start spiraling about this FBI file like I did.
He was very close to the Soviet ambassador Umansky while in Mexico. When Umansky died in an airplane accident, you know, of course, everything points that he was assassinated. Then it was already 46, and Meyer had no longer the same interest in still being involved in this heavy politics of the Soviet embassy. And at the same time the war was over, all of the exile was getting back to the GDR. So he stood here, I would say, very lonely. His Italian friends left, and his entire world was already getting back to Europe, and he was still working on some projects here in Mexico, so he couldn't leave. And, you know, it was a difficult period for him just to think, should I stay, should I go? So it took 3 more years for him to take the final decision to leave. But since 1946, his entire political world somehow left.
Dann gerät in die Querelen der Exildebatte.
He was then faced with the problem that he was strongly anchored in this immigration culture and that he then took over the management of these graphic design workshops, the Taller de Grafica Popular, relatively late, and was able to bring his cultural and organizational talent to the table and thus also devote himself to indigenous cultures and, above all, to the completely different understanding of folklore, which he always saw positively, and not just as esotericism or as a kind of mannerism, so that you have to see different phases there as well. You have to take a really close look at which phase you are in. Is he still in a state function? Then he gets caught up in the quarrels of the exile debate. Unfortunately, he came into great conflict with the German exile too, especially with the arrival of Paul Merker, who took over the leadership of the German Communist Organization. Like the Spaniards, he himself was a member of the Mexican Communist Party, while the KPD members had their own organization. And so he came into great conflict with Paul Merker and was then also expelled from the Mexican Communist Party at the insistence of the KPD. These personal and political debates actually made it impossible for him to regain a foothold in Germany, especially in the DDR, after his time in Mexico.
Ihn auch da in eine gewisse Isolation gebracht am Ende der Immigrationszeit. Also ich sehe eine ganz große Tragik darin, dass Hannes Meyer.
I see a great tragedy in the fact that Hannes Meyer was unable to regain a foothold in Europe, neither in the East nor in the West. At times, he also hoped to use his good contacts with the Italian communists to establish himself there. And so for him, the new realism of the film people, together with the partisan movement and experience of Italy, was a crazy starting point, and he would have loved to be part of it. There was the idea via communist senators that he would also build cultural centers or whatever in Italy. None of that happened. And the fact is that various factions of the Comintern, the international communist movement, apparently got in conflict. Hannes Meyer was right in the middle of it. And that the appalling formalism debate and the decree, i.e. the orientation towards national traditions, declared Hannes Meyer to be one of the sworn enemies of the socialist development of architecture in the DDR, which was linked, among other things, to this famous architect's trip to Moscow in the spring of 1950, where 2 former Bauhaus members, Edmund Kollein and Waldemar Alder, were among the participants. Hannes Meyer was also in correspondence with Alder at the time. Contact then suddenly broke off when they were told in Moscow that Walter Gropius, Ernst May and Hannes Meyer were the main proponents of formalism and that they should not be contacted. Of course, the development in East Germany would have been completely different if you consider Hannes Meyer, who was certainly difficult for many people. It is a great tragedy that Hannes Meyer's experience and the opportunity to rebuild his career in the DDR were so carelessly ignored. These were aesthetic reasons, but they were also primarily political, and we are not yet aware of all the details, which also include certain secret service activities or political factions that played a role in the international movement. And in this respect, there's an enormous problem associated with this. This also affected other people who were closely associated with the DDR and the Soviet Union's socialist development. Many of these well-intentioned, talented people have been left out in the cold. Their willingness to work for the DDR was not really utilized, and they were excluded. In this context, Hermann Henselmann also played a particularly disadvantageous role. Although he wasn't in Moscow himself, he felt he had to deal with Hannes Meyer, and Hannes Meyer was following the situation very closely in Mexico, albeit with a time lag, by reading the ND, the Neue Deutschland newspaper, every day. And even when he was back in Switzerland and had contact with Hans Schmidt again, they of course discussed the situation immediately, and at some point it became clear that they had no chance in the DDR.
Und irgendwann war klar, dass sie in der DDR keine Chance haben.
There was no place for him, so he had to go back to Switzerland. He finally said, okay, so the Ticino is halfway from Milano where I can meet my Italian friends and the Zurich so I can see the family as well. So it's halfway and it's not as expensive as other places. This kind of sad story. So at some point he said, if I wanted to become rich, this is the platform to do so. But this is not what I want. So what you have to give up, it was much more important than to be wealthy. And you never know if he would have been in any case, but that's not what he wanted. Yeah, I think that he was truthful to whatever he believed and that he gave up his architectural talent for his ideology. I do believe so, that at the very end, what he wanted was to build a new world. That was his aim. And he would do it either through architecture, through the arts, or through politics, or ideology, whatever you want to call it. The truth is that he had this larger-than-life aim that it was impossible to fulfill. He was sentenced to failure because it was such an impossible task. It's part of that sadness of his history, isn't it?
The numerous letters that Hannes Meyer exchanged with friends, colleagues and former Bauhaus friends, among others with Kay Adams, Carola Bloch, Heinrich Stark, Waldemar Alda, Tibor Weiner and Max Gebhardt can still be found in several archives. They document this last part of Meyer's political engagement from 1947 until 1953 and his several efforts to be used as an experienced urban planner, as he put it himself. Neither a position in Italy, where many of his Mexican friends had gone after World War II, nor the different possibilities that could have worked out for him in the DDR, that eventually and abruptly came to a halt when the 16 principles of urban development were established, which didn't foresee a new way of building in the DDR, but rather to copy the socialist classicism style from the Soviet Union. This goes hand in hand with the above-mentioned so-called formalism debate, in which formalist architecture, so the emphasis on the form, the arrangement, the structure and the outward appearance of a building, of a content meaning, was denounced. The architect Hermann Henselmann, the one who built the famous Stadionallee in Berlin, which is today Karl-Marx-Allee, had to publicly distance himself from such architecture in the Neue Deutschland, the ND, the newspaper of the leading party of the DDR. Hannes Meyer was one of the architects denounced for his formalist architecture during his era at the Bauhaus. Meyer, on the other hand, couldn't understand the fuss about his person and his architecture, as he had already turned away from that kind of architecture when he went to the Soviet Union in 1930. He, once again, was in a political predicament and was unable to actively participate in the discussion about him. It is those kinds of details, and there are many more, that experts like Dara, Tatiana, Raquel and Thomas discovered. And believe me, it is absolutely worth reading more about Hannes Meyer, because even though he had been largely ignored over Walter Gropius and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, this has drastically changed now. Thanks to books like Hannes Meyer im Streit der Deutungen, there is today an extensive knowledge available to the public. I will link the most important books and articles that are also part of my very own Bauhaus library at home in the show notes. You will see that, although I have published three parts of this episode with more or less 1 hour each, there are still parts of Hannes Meyer's life that we only have touched on the surface, like his co-op room, his involvement with the avant-garde theater, or his difficult relationship with the Mexican painter Diego Rivera and with Paul Merker, whom he referred to as der Dicke, the fat one, in his letters. I would lastly like to thank Raquel Franklin for her instant willingness to be part of this episode. I think it is a worthy end for this podcast episode on Hannes Meyer. With the help of Dara Kiese, Tatiana Ifrussi, Raquel Franklin and Thomas Fliel, I was able to revisit my own research on Hannes Meyer and to expand my knowledge in so many ways. But most of all, thank you for all these amazing interactions across countries and continents. I am more than grateful that we all have been able to make it work and create this very special three-part podcast episode. If you liked the episode, please take now a few seconds and give Bauhaus Faces a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or a thumbs up on YouTube. This way you help that the podcast platforms recommend my podcast to other Bauhaus enthusiasts. Of course, the best way is still if you tell everyone around you who might be interested in Bauhaus Faces about it. Help spread the word and let's have our community grow. My next short-term goal is to hit the 500 subscribers barrier. That's only roughly 100 to go. Will you help me? For additional material, you can also follow me on Instagram, where I am at Bauhaus Faces Podcast, or have a look on the Bauhaus Faces Podcast website, bauhausfaces.com. And now there's nothing left to say, but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.